My name is Charlie Mays, and this morning we're going to be talking about a theme that really is also the title of a book, Jesus Means Freedom. And this is somewhat in the order of an introduction to this book, and somewhat of also a picking up of what I think are major New Testament themes that are there whether you read this book or not. The book that I refer to is this paperback book by Ernst Käsemann, entitled Jesus Means Freedom. The subtitle of the book is A Polemical Survey of the New Testament. And it's important that you understand what he means by a polemical survey, because when he wrote this book, which was written in 1968, he was fairly angry with the German church. And so this book is an exercise, as he says in the introduction, to dealing with his anger. And so it's not intended to be a scholarly work, but rather a polemical work that kind of sets some arguments that he thinks the church needs to discuss. Before I begin any kind of thing, how many of you have read this book or are familiar with it? Okay, we have at least two. So you will be getting not what Käsemann says, but what I say Käsemann says, and that may be very distinct. What I hope to do is to provoke you to buy this book and to use it, because it's a book that I use about once a year. I go back and read it so that I get juiced up again about the gospel, because I think his name, Käsemann. I want to say a word or two about Käsemann and what I know about him. Käsemann has written several other things available in English that I am familiar with. He has a little volume called New Testament Questions for Today, and it's written along the same kind of thought processes as this one, namely that there are questions which the New Testament puts to us today and questions which today puts to the New Testament, and so that in the midst of that dialogue between the New Testament and today, there's something that the church can learn if it listens. Also, in April 1971, the Interpretation, which is a journal of Bible and theology published by Union Seminary in Richmond, Virginia, devoted their entire issue to a statement that was developed by the evangelical or Lutheran churches in Germany. And Käsemann has a section in that book on the Pauline theology of the cross. And I think it's an absolutely seminal piece in which you really, if you don't understand this book, perhaps the place to start would be with that Pauline theology of the cross in that April 1971 Interpretation Journal, because it really tells you what Käsemann is about. Käsemann has also published recently a commentary on Romans, and I think that it is the commentary on Romans. It is Roy Harrisville in either Interpretation or Word and World, and I can't remember which, reviewed it. Roy Harrisville is a professor at Luther Northwestern Seminaries. And Roy has written the first book in Augsburg series of Bible commentaries, and his was on Romans, and in essence he says Käsemann's is the commentary on Romans. Käsemann does his commentary on Romans from the perspective of a theology of the cross, and it's just a masterpiece. For pastors who are ever going to preach on Romans, there's no way that you could find anything better. The last I heard of Käsemann, he was getting ready to leave the Lutheran Church in Germany. Whether he did or not, I don't know, or whether he was just in one of his fits of anger again. But he was very perturbed with a church that would not allow its students to engage in Marxist Christian dialogue. He just could not understand that the church cannot be open enough to engage in that dialogue and have the freedom to do that. And so he was going to go become a Methodist or something. I don't know what became of that. But he's a fascinating writer because he puts his own self on the line, and I really appreciate that, and I appreciate it very much in this volume. Now, a few words about, and I'm going to kind of go through some stuff here because it's probably easier for me to let him speak, and then you can flesh it out a little bit later. But What I understand Kaiserman to be arguing for is that Christian freedom is God's gift. It is God's gift to the church. And it is a gift which must be renewed, in essence, in every generation, in every life, and indeed day by day. And that the difficulty that the church has with this freedom is it does not know how to handle it. That we cannot live with the freedom that the gospel brings, that we're always trying to make an idol of it. We're trying to make an idol, more correctly, perhaps, of our understanding of the gospel. And the freedom that we want to claim for ourselves is not always the freedom that we give to others. He says the process of limiting the freedom of the gospel is beginning to take place in the New Testament itself. That the constriction of freedom that comes in Jesus Christ is already beginning to be lost in the New Testament materials. Now, that's pretty radical stuff. And he tries to demonstrate in this book just how various New Testament materials begin to restrict Christian freedom. Now, I want to share something that he says, and I think this is very important that one understands his argument in regard to the loss of Christian freedom. And you know, the thing is, in Paul's churches, and you have to remember, Kaiserman is very much a Lutheran. He's very Pauline. And so Paul is, for him, in essence, the canon for the New Testament, the criteria by which you measure everything else. He's Lutheran enough to say that Jesus Christ is the standard by which everything is measured, the Bible itself. And so you can have a rather cavalier attitude towards Scripture, even as Luther had when he called James a right strawy epistle and wondered what Revelation was doing in the New Testament. And he left them there, and that's a clue, I think. But nonetheless, to have this kind of radical approach to Scripture. Now, what he says is happening, and this I want to make very clear about this, how Christian freedom gets restricted, and what he proposes to do about that. On page 95, he says, "How did the situation come about that we regard as the real cause of offense, namely that the church was identified with the reign of God and regarded as the earthly representative of the power of Christ?" Here he's criticizing the book of Ephesians, which makes membership in the church a criteria for, or makes the church in essence equal to Christ. And he says that's a terrible situation. It's terrible for the church to equate itself to the reign of God. But he says the answer, briefly stated, is because of urgency and necessity. Urgency and necessity are always the really productive situations, although they are certain to provoke dangers too. In other words, in an historical situation, it becomes necessary to do some things to guard the gospel. Another way that he says it, and this is now when he says it, that you have to do this, but it does provoke dangers. Now he's going to address himself to the dangers. This is on page 99. To take suitable action in an emergency is one thing. To turn what is necessary on a single occasion into something unchangeable is another. Have we not shut ourselves up intolerably within what is old, conventional, and time-honored, and turned ourselves into a religious ghetto in relation to other peoples? Has not the price of the church order that we have gained been too high after all, once the days of the enthusiasts and the persecution were over? Do we not need a root and branch reformation for the sake of what is appropriate, necessary, and urgent today? Today the church alone, as a company of free people, has the promise that it should glorify Jesus' name before the world and carry out its appointed service in the world. We have to learn again that in the everyday life of secularism, every single Christian represents the church. For that, however, one must offer something more than order, namely the disciples' freedom that is the spirit, the fruit of the Spirit. Now, what he's saying, I think, in this, and I want to dwell on this for a few moments because it's utterly critical. The church moved to celibacy, and I'll use celibacy as an example because it's not a problem among us. When the church was made a legal entity following the Edict of Milan by Constantine and could hold property They did not have such an animal as corporate entity, corporations. So who owned the church property? Well, the bishop did, or the presiding minister of the congregation, or as it became in metropolitan areas, the bishop of the several congregations. So the bishop owned the property, and the idea was, of course, that he, and I use that advisedly, he owned that in the church's name. And so the theory was, and the practice probably was pretty much at the beginning, when that bishop died, another bishop was elected, then he held title to the property. But pretty soon folks began to notice was that the next bishop was the previous bishop's son. So for all intents and purposes, what was happening? A family had control of the church property, which was becoming more extensive and more wealthy. So the church says, we'll fix that situation. So they made a rule that in order to be bishop, you should not be married. That takes care of inheritors right there, at least legitimate ones. That was sometime in the 4th or 5th century. In the 9th century, somebody said, well, what's good for the head goose is good for the rest of the geese. And so they made all priests celibate. Now, what Kaiserman would say to that situation is this, that probably there was a good reason for them to come up with celibate bishops. There probably would have been another solution to it, but nonetheless, at that historical time, that was the situation the church came up with. But why then set that into concrete? And that's what the church has often done, is that something that was at one time an innovation in response to an historical situation, the historical situation passes away, and we leave ourselves with the fossil of a practice. I'll give you another example. The restriction at the Lord's table and the whole emphasis on that the Lord's Supper is for the baptized only. And you all know enough, I think, about early church history to know the problems they had and that before they went into the Eucharistic meal, they excused the unbaptized and all of that. Why? Because of the persecution. But we're no longer a persecuted church, no longer in that historical situation. So why all of the boundaries? Why all of the walls built around the Lord's Supper? The historical occasion that gave rise to that practice is gone. And that's not the essence of the meal. Now, he says some of those kind of things were already happening in the New Testament. We have to be aware that when those practices were given birth to, that there was legitimate reason for the time being, for the sake of the gospel, to kind of build some hedges. But once we move to a new day, the gospel has to come again in new wineskins. I think that unless we understand that about Kaiserman, we're going to be in trouble. The other thing that we need to understand, think about Kaiserman, is that he is a thoroughgoing theologian of the cross. And so when he talks about freedom, I think we need to be fairly clear about what he means by freedom. And there, the passage that we could utilize is the passage in Galatians when he talks about, for freedom Christ has set us free. And then we do not use that occasion, we do not use that freedom then as an occasion for the flesh. We can look in chapter 5, verse 13, and just to share that for a minute. For you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love be servants of one another. That, in his judgment, is Christian freedom. And there's a lot of things, a lot of other places where he could proof text that. But the freedom that we enjoy as the sons and daughters of God is the freedom that we have in Christ, who said in what he calls the gospel of freedom, Mark's gospel that Jerry talked about this morning, that for the Son of Man came not to serve, to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, that he lived out that freedom, Jesus did. Okay, now we'll get into some more of that understanding of uh, of the theology of the cross and what that freedom means. What I'd like to do now is kind of walk through this book and read some quotes. Some of these are bombshells that I think if you just puzzle over them, you know, it's just worth the trip. He said, and this is what I've been trying to say on page 9, I see the whole of the New Testament as involving the cause of Christian freedom, and I have done my best to show that that cause is developed in much diversity because it exists only in terms of practical, mundane affairs in relation to Christian selflessness, or selfishness, excuse me, Christian selfishness, stupidity, misrepresentation, and denial, and changes its spearhead from time to time. I really like his understanding of the church that, as Jerry pointed out with Mark's gospel, you know, the disciples in Mark's gospel are gross stupid. And the gospel doesn't depend on their intelligence. And that that this Christian freedom that we've been given is exercised in terms of practical, mundane affairs. That it exists in relation to Christian selfishness, stupidity, misrepresentation, and denial, and that it changes its spearhead from time to time. Now, that means that what Luther was after is not necessarily what we need to be after about what the gospel addresses. Namely, Luther had a terribly troubled conscience. And as I think Christer Stendahl in his book, Paul Among Jews and Gentiles, has shown very graphically, that Paul was not about a troubled conscience. Paul bragged about everything he did. You know, he said in 1 Corinthians he says, I am what I am by the grace of God. And that's very humble, right? Yet he says, I did more than any of the rest of them, although not really me, but the grace of God which is at work at me. I mean, Paul had a very robust conscience. Luther read Paul through his eyes, was looking for something else. And so that's what Kaseman means by changing its spearhead. That's why we need to listen, I think, to liberation theologians and what they see in the gospel is not a whole lot of stuff about forgiveness of sin. Read the gospel sometime and see how little there is about that. I mean, we read it with certain kinds of, the spearhead changes. There are times when we do need to hear forgiveness, but other times when we need to hear liberation and freedom. All right. Then I like some of the things he puts down what it means in my parish, and I can lay this, and some of my members are here this morning, and so they will understand somewhat of what I try to be about. But he talks about what faith is, and this, I think, has to do with when you come to church on Sunday, what do you expect to hear? Page 14. As if faith consisted in hearing what one expects as a matter of course in divine service, and what is felt at least by ourselves, if not by the world, to be tolerable. We cry murder without noticing that creeping death is at work everywhere. While we extol rebirth, we forget that it presupposes a dying that is new every day and goes down into the very depths of our being as well as a living despair of our own godliness. Anyone who does not discern and hate and oppose the old Adam in the church really ought not to be shocked by its continuance outside the church. Where mere edification and boredom spread themselves, there can be no resounding gospel message, even if the whole Bible has been read aloud. In view of these considerations, we ask whether the church itself knows how things stand with regard to its essential nature. Can the church define this nature sharply in a single word or sentence, so that all other questions and answers are brought into the context of such a definition? Do you think your home congregation could define its essence in a sentence? Could it put its what it's about in one succinct problem statement? He says we couldn't. Then he goes on, this page 21. But he says, our faith cannot rest on a theology and therefore not on theirs, however important theology may be for the development and right understanding of faith. Our faith rests on what Adolf Schlatter in his last little book expressed in the question, do we know Jesus? And on nothing else. Whatever the volumes of dogmatics and creeds may consider necessary, nothing else is necessary but to deal with the question, do we know Jesus? We just have to be continually learning. Learning afresh, better and more deeply, and when Jesus is concerned, we are never finished learning. That's page 23. And you see, if we could get ourselves in the stance of having so much more yet to learn about Jesus, how radically would that change our relationship to others, especially as Lutherans? Think about the controversies among us. What do they stem over? How much I know about Jesus and how little you do. Right? That we somehow have a corner on the truth and nobody else understands anything. Instead of seeing that as far as Jesus is concerned, we're never done with the learning. And that if we could spend our time listening, we might learn something from someone else. And I think that's terribly important. And Kaseman argues strongly, it seems to me, for involvement in the world, and he does it on the basis of the first article. And so on page 25, he talks about, you know, how in the world did we ever get in the situation of playing God off against his creation? As if it's somehow more pious to be at worship than it is to be at work in political structures and involved in efforts to save the creation. He says, there is no God who ceases to be a creator and who can therefore be played off against what has been created. There is no such thing as a God-pleasing religion that absolves us from our everyday duties. And there is no holy scripture that allows man to sin and relieves us of our absolute responsibility toward our neighbor. And he goes on to say, the creator claims his creation and therefore requires our unconditional love of our neighbor and our unqualified readiness to serve and to forgive, because anything else or anything less means the ruin of every creature. Love is the fulfilling of the law. Piety that stands in the way of love stands in the way of God himself, and no theology or dogmatics has the slightest justification for arguing the counter or the contrary. Okay, I think that's pretty tough stuff that he's putting out. One of the things that, and we'll talk about this in a minute, one of the things that he always wants us to understand is that Jesus is not a model, not primarily a model for us, but he is the object of our faith. And he criticizes the book of Hebrews for making Jesus the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, that we run after him and model ourselves after him. He thinks that's not adequate enough. Anyway, we can get into that a little later. Let me say a few things. This I've already introduced about this idea of being a learner and what that would do to us in terms of our relationship to one another. At the bottom of page 31, I'm just picking up in the middle of a sentence, the believer is exchanged for the accomplisher. That's what happens among us when we think our faith is the center of things. How little it is noticed, even in the Christian world, that Jesus did not first teach his disciples to worship, but to ask. The doxology in the Matthean text of the Lord's Prayer is a later addition by the church, as the parallel Lucan text shows. For him, the attitude that man has to express is primarily that of need, which is not surpassed even by worship. That we go, as in Luther's terms, as beggars in need. Now, about a third of the way down the page, Jesus did not tie up judgment with our shortcomings. The gift received is the ground of judgment as of salvation. ought that not to be significant for our mutual fellowship? How much easier Christian solidarity would be if we respected in our neighbor, first of all, what he has received, what he has learned for himself from the Bible and practices in his life. We, with our own knowledge, actions, and even faith, are not his standard. He is judged and blessed by what God has given him. In short, under the first commandment, God and the world and men are not as we imagine them, but we are convinced not only that Jesus fulfilled that commandment, but that even more, he made it seen, heard, and acted on. The first commandment without Jesus, or indeed against him, becomes a law of death, whereas interpreted by Jesus, it becomes the basis of human freedom and the sum of all theology and real piety, and opens one's eyes to understanding the truth. Think of what that means, to accept one another for what we have been given and not what we lack, knowing that we all come on the basis of our need and God is filling that need. That's interesting, I think, and provocative. Then he talks about, and I think this is where, one of the things, it's interesting if you were to study the New Testament, the gospel stories in the New Testament, on the basis of the way the disciples are portrayed, you would find a radical difference in the way that they come across. I've already alluded to the fact that in Mark, the disciples are gross stupid, and so as Jerry pointed out this morning in the Bible study on Mark, Jesus is forever asking them, do you not know, do you not understand, do you not perceive? But he does not ask that question in Matthew. In Matthew, the question is always, and if you look at the parallel passages, it is always, O you of little faith! The Matthean disciples have it figured out, but like me, they don't act on it. And so Kaseman has a word about knowledge and acting. This is on the bottom of page 35, top of page 36. He says, for according to my theology, which I have been learning laboriously for 40 years, what is decisive for all time is not how much we have believed, but that we have believed and followed him, however little we have understood about him. We Lutherans have been real heavy on the understanding about him, and not so stressing on the obedience of faith. There's a good historical reason for that. We really worry about making our obedience an act of works, but it's played a trick on us. And so Kaseman would call that into question. The stuff I've been just sharing is from the chapter called Was Jesus a Liberal? And I would, if I had the time, well, maybe I'll take the time to read the little introductory thing for that, because it is such a neat little story. He says, I was told the following story in Amsterdam after the severe storms and floods from which Holland suffered in 1952. The scene was one of those parishes where people felt themselves strictly bound to obey God's commandments, and therefore to keep the Sabbath holy. The place was so threatened by wind and waves that the dike had to be strengthened one Sunday if the inhabitants were to survive. The police notified the pastor, who now found himself in a religious difficulty. Should he call out the people of the parish that had been entrusted to him and set them to do the necessary work if it meant profaning the Sabbath? Should he, on the contrary, abandon them to destruction in order to honor the Sabbath? He found the burden of making a personal decision too much for him, and he summoned the church council to consult and decide. The discussion went on as one might suppose. We live to carry out God's will. God, being omnipotent, can always perform a miracle with the wind and waves. Our duty is obedience, whether in life or in death. The pastor tried one last argument, perhaps against his own conviction. Did not Jesus himself on occasion break the fourth commandment and declare that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath? Thereupon, the venerable old man stood up. I have always been troubled, Pastor, by something that I have never yet ventured to say publicly. Now I must say it. I have always had the feeling that our Lord Jesus was just a bit liberal.
Yeah.
One of the arguments that he has about the church, and I really, I say this autobiographically before I say it critically in any other way, and that is that we are so boring. I mean, I think he says that's one of our great sins. He says, we shall speak of this in detail later on. At the moment, we are regretting that the Christian world in general and its representatives in particular mostly give the impression of being so colorless, anemic, and lacking in robustness. Inconspicuousness is regarded as their special characteristic, whereas resilient human vitality, personal characteristics, and intellectual independence seem out of place in them. Even with the so-called laity, an invisible gown lends a dignity that the wearer as much as such does not possess. If the Holy Spirit does not make people more human, he very often seems to make them unhuman, we may doubt whether he is really holy. Then I want to move to some, this is a passage that did me in. Anyone to whom preaching is not refused is also worthy of the Lord's Supper, provided he himself does not refuse it. For Christ comes to the ungodly even on Sunday morning. His coming ends ungodliness and makes us worthy. Otherwise, we are establishing in the heart of Protestantism an utterly ungodly and unworthy preoccupation with works. Children, the unbaptized, to whoever we preach, it is not a different grace. It is the same grace on word and sacrament. It's his coming that ends our unworthiness. I grew up in a home. My mother, I grew up in a Norwegian pietistic parish. We had communion four times a year. There were times when my mother would not go because she was not worthy. What is the sacrament about? It's about ending our unworthiness. I read this book first in 1974, and I've been trying to deal with the really radicalness of it ever since.
We have a pastor in Cleveland who was Lutheran, had come out of the Reformed tradition. His mother remained in the Reformed tradition, and on her deathbed, he would not give her communion. Because she was not a Lutheran.
Yeah, it's incredible. But you see, I contend that in our practice of the Lord's Supper, we have become Gnostics. For admission to the Lord's Supper depends upon what we know. Drilled into my little brain, where the pastor found it one time and drilled into it. And he said, using 1 Corinthians 11, that whoever does not discern the body eats and drinks to his own condemnation. Now, the thing that nobody ever did is read the rest of the chapter, the beginning of the chapter, and found out that body refers not to the elements, but to the church as the Summa Christu. Luther has a very interesting remark on that on page 58 of volume 54, his Table Talks. And he says that passage about discernment is obviously addressed to adults and therefore not to children, and we should not refuse them. And it's very interesting. when you read Luther, what he has to say about why we should have children at the Lord's table, and he never really practiced that in any radical way that we can find, and we need to say that. He says, you know why? Because we have much to learn from them about faith. Interesting.
It would be kind of interesting to know how many people here have ever experienced this restriction of freedom of communion. Just raise your hand.
I went to a church conference once and got there late, missed the confession, and the pastor who was doing it wouldn't let us commune. We were Lutheran pastors who missed the confession.
I went to a Missouri Synod church, and because I was an LCA, they wouldn't let me commune.
Along with being a liberal, Kaseman is also clear in pointing out that Jesus was devout.
Oh, yes.
He's liberal and devout. And this statement on page 20, that may a church or a denomination continue to call itself Christian if its devout members have ceased to be liberal and its liberal members can no longer be regarded as devout. Is a man a Christian if he separates two things that are inseparable in his Lord?
Yeah.
That's
powerful. Yeah. It's as Chuck's remarks are showing, we're only hitting part of the grain here. I mean, there is stuff here that's that goes on and on. And when he gets into the section which is a discussion of the Corinthian correspondence, and I'm now on page 67. The chapter is entitled "For and Against the Theology of Resurrection," and this is where you really have to understand the what he's getting at in terms of a theology of the cross. You see, the crucifixion was not an event on the road to resurrection. It wasn't just the stopping place. It is the place. Okay. The risen and exalted one remains the crucified one, and his sovereignty is not understood and acknowledged if the cross is merely made the last station on his earthly way, as in fact is done by enthusiasts. Risen so as to be Lord means risen so that the cross may conquer the world. Then he says, the only distinctive mark that completely separates Christianity from other religions and their gods is the cross. Now, till we understand that, and I think we'll be our whole life understanding that, again, to go to Mark's gospel, when you get to chapter 15, and picking up the crucifixion scene in Mark's gospel, which is the earliest gospel written, and if you drop the reference, which I think is a theological reference, to the temple's curtain being torn in two from the top to the bottom, which would not have been available to the Roman centurion, he would not have seen that. So if you look at that scene, and he sees Jesus die, and what does he hear Jesus say? My God, why have you forsaken me? And what does that death move him to say? Truly, this was the Son of God. Now, that is a very strange God who comes and whose fullest revelation, fullest self-disclosure, comes in a person killed as a criminal. And Martin Hengel, in a little book called Crucifixion, shows that in every culture to which the Christian message was addressed in its time, crucifixion was a scandal, an utter scandal. In every culture. Never read Hengel's book, Crucifixion, unless you're having an absolutely perfect day, because it's gross when he goes through what crucifixion means. Now, the interesting thing, it's very hard for us to get into a theology of the cross living where we do. But if we lived in most of the world, getting into a theology of the cross would make that God available to us. Douglas Hall, in his book, has The Church of Future, talks about the fact that we want to turn this whole crucifixion thing into a success story. And if we make Jesus a success story, we remove him from the experience of every human being, because by the world standards, all of us will fail. If we fail by no other thing, we can fail like Howard Hughes did. Right? I mean, that's one sense of failure no greater than any of the rest of us. It's just more tragic.
There are other biblical commentators who say, along with Caseman, that scandal of the cross in Mark, which was probably the earliest recording, where Mark ends with that statement, God, why have you forsaken me? Period. From that point on, there are other little additions, almost as if the church couldn't live with that terror. What kind of a God is that who denies his only son or seems to be looking away at that hour of death? Because some of the others write, into thy hands I commend my spirit, you know. Already, the impact of the scandal of the cross is sort of weakened with that simple phrase, you know, Jesus gives up.
Jerry pointed out in his Bible study this morning that the book of Mark, and I'm convinced it's the one that ends at Mark's hands, ends with the almost impossible Greek construction with the gar, the preposition for is the last word in the thing. There are these crazy women running around saying nothing to no one out of great fear. End of the gospel. Actually, it's the end of the beginning of the gospel, because I think the title at Mark is, when he says the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, he means that for the whole gospel. Then what is the word? Go to Galilee and there you will see him. And what does he do in Galilee? Preaches, teaches, heals. He does ministry. There you will see him. All right, anyway, enough of that preaching. Now when he talks about this limit of what is the limit of Christian freedom, and we've not spelled out Christian freedom and all of that, and I'm aware of that, but I want to leave you enough frustrated so that you will want to pick the book up. So,
before you get to that, can I say one thing about the resurrection? Because this shocks me too. But I think it's a word that we need to hear. Caseman sees in the writings in Corinthians that the Corinthian congregation has fallen so in love with the idea of resurrection that it denies Jesus Christ. And that may be hard to follow, but he's saying, and I think it's a judgment of our own time too, that people are so interested in the gift they get from Christ that they give up the giver.
Yeah.
They idolize the gifts and forsake the giver.
And he argues, you know, we're all into theories of the atonement, you know, just how was it that Jesus saved us? And he wants to strike that down, particularly in his discussion of the book of Hebrews. And he will say, you know, if we read the New Testament fairly carefully, one of the things that we will discover is that atonement theory in Hebrews is only one among many. That's why at the beginning of the book he wants to talk about the diversity of the New Testament. And we get so interested in the atonement theories that in fact the theory becomes more important than what happened. And so he wants to it's like when we consider the cross and we wonder about, well, now how was God saving the world? And so we want to work out some system for that. And then also we finally want to come down and invest it only in ourselves. And he says we replace Christology, who is Jesus, with soteriology, how am I saved? And that's, he won't countenance that replacement. And what Chuck is saying about his argument with this emphasis on resurrection is that you become, as the little cliche goes, you become so utterly heavenly minded that you're no earthly good. And what it means to be buried with Christ and therefore raised with Christ means that we can now turn our attention to this world. That's really what, you know, I think that's what he's arguing for. And to go back to Mark's gospel again, the grammatical construction of the words of the young man or the angel or whatever it is in the tomb in Mark 16 is very interesting. And the English translations don't pick it up. It says, you seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He is not here, he is risen. Well, The "he is risen" is really a Greek verbal construction that's passive, and it's also in the past tense. It has happened. It is completed and over with. His resurrection is. But the crucifixion is an imperfect tense. It means it's an action which has happened in the past, the consequence of which continues into the future. So that when he says in here that Jesus remains the crucified one, you see, Jesus will be crucified till the end of time. Inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did not do it to me. That Jesus continues to be crucified. Wherever humankind is oppressed, is in pain, Jesus is crucified, still. Now, think of John 3:16 for a minute, and let I say, and not facetiously either, that of all the jobs in the universe that I would not want God's job. Because to be God means to suffer ultimately till the end of time. If God so loved the world that he gave his only son, if that's the depth of his love, think of how pained he is at the way we live. You ever thought of that? Have you ever had that concept of God? To be the waiting father looking down the road day by day by day for errant children who never come to their senses, who never come home. To be God, I think, means to suffer ultimately still. Now that's, you know, you may want to mull that one around a whole lot. But think of the passage in Hosea about, you know, Hosea 11, which is a beautiful, beautiful passage. If you go back to Deuteronomy and you look at what you're supposed to do with a rebellious son, if you have an incorrigible child, in according to the Deuteronomic law, and this is for people that are really into capital punishment, we ought to be into it all the way. I mean, if you're going to support capital punishment on the basis of the Bible, then do it all the way, or don't mess with it. And so if you have an incorrigible child and you try to straighten this child out and nothing works, you drag the child before the elders at the city gate and say that this is an incorrigible child, and so they stone him to death. Now, if you get into Hosea 11, you'll see the structure of Hosea 11 is that Israel is a rebellious child. And so Hosea 11, 1 and 2 says, out of Egypt did I call my son. The more I called to him, the more he went astray. And then there is the indictment. So Israel deserves to be killed. But then what does Hosea record God as saying? How can I give you up, Ephraim? How I am not man, but God, the Holy One among you. Pain. My God, the pain of what it must mean to be God. We think in heaven, you know, I think that we have a lot of rethinking to do. And that's just one, you can go home and think about that and think about what a heretic it is. And like one guest up here earlier in the summer said, I certainly feel sorry for some congregations that have to put up with pastors who go out on crusades. And I think I knew one of whom he was speaking. But anyway, I think is something that, and if my experience as a parent is any indication, and my kids are good kids, pretty much. Let's move to 83, because this gets to the theme that Chuck talked about this personal stuff. The third characteristic of resurrection as seen in a Christian light is that it takes place in the power of the first commandment. He keeps coming back to the first commandment. That may strike you as strange, but he says that Jesus lived the first commandment first as promise, and that's very Lutheran. If you read Luther's large catechism, the first thing he says about the first commandment, you shall have no, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me, is that God chooses to be your God. That's the promise of the first commandment. And Jesus lived the first commandment, first as promise, and then as commandment. Now I've got a lecture on the Ten Commandments. You can go listen to that stuff and get straightened out on that, so I won't go into it now. But we got a whole rethinking to do about the law, and I've got another series I do on a little book that's also available in the bookstore. This could be your New Testament library. What Does God Say About the Old Testament by Klaus Westerman could be your Old Testament library. You'll never read either Old or New Testament the same after reading those two books. Anyway, he says, it therefore reveals the glorious liberty of the children of God, toward which, according to Romans 8:21, the whole of world history is directed, because it is the real permanent sign of the Son and of his sovereignty. Any theology of the resurrection which cannot speak of this liberty, which does not prepare the way for it, which prompts us to accept articles of faith but not to practice this liberty, misses the central point of the history of salvation and of the world. We do indeed talk about our personal relationship to the exalted Lord, and by that we mean the possibility and reality of Christian prayer. But that merely shows how poverty-stricken and self-centered our faith has become. After all, non-Christians sometimes pray, and they too find lords in heaven and on earth who comfort them. This, of course, is not said in order to decry prayer. What is vital is that the hope of resurrection should not end here, and that it should not be concentrated on serving private devoutness. The resurrection of the dead means a new world, and therefore creates a being who will no longer resign himself to the old conditions that now prevail on the earth. Just one quote, Carl Broughton in a book called The Future of God says, you know, if you read the Gospels, if you read the New Testament, what it has done is it has placed dynamite into all of the critical structures of our society. And it would be nice if the church would start playing with matches. Because we have seen the vision of a new creation, and that won't let the old structure stand. And if we see resurrection only as our personal guarantee that it'll be okay with me, we've missed the point. 2 Corinthians 5, if anyone is in Christ, behold, a new creation. Not he is a new creature, as it's probably incorrectly. You wonder why I don't translate the New Testament, don't you? Because I don't know anything. But anyway, another thing about this personal stuff. He says, regarded sociologically and historically, the great theologians are almost always fomenters of unrest, and their tactical and organizational detachment still forms part of the well-tried practices of ecumenical efforts. The enthusiasts, however, slacken off in the course of a generation. People and institutions do not like to be kept continually on the alert, and they have constantly devised screens to protect themselves from too much heat. In fact, they have even managed to reduce Jesus' red-hot message, which promised to kindle a fire throughout the world, to room temperature. So they are now well able to deal with people who imagine God's reign to be somewhat explosive, dangerous, and breathtaking. In the same manner as the watchword of freedom recedes, there accumulate in the later period of early Christianity the admonitions to live a godly life in quietness and integrity. He says, I am very far from wanting to ridicule this. On the contrary, it is advisable even today to break a lance for it on occasion when unripe youth is too quick in sweeping it off the board. On the other hand, we should remember that hardly any saying has so markedly shaped Christianity as has that about godliness in quietness and integrity. It has been combined intolerably with the political maxim that calmness is the citizen's first duty. He wants us to get out, do something. We want to move on.
Chuck. The idea of resurrection is new creation. I can't remember if it was Caseman or somebody who said that that a church that proclaims resurrection as only revivification is most to be pitied. In other words, if we think of resurrection only as life after death, we don't have much to talk about. That resurrection is a whole new creation. It's much bigger than just dead bodies coming alive again.
Yeah, and you see, I like to think of it, if I live now by grace, then whatever happens to me after death, that'll be by grace too. So that means that the private and personal kinds of things in terms of what the message of resurrection means is that in essence God is saying, Charlie, I've taken care of it for you. That's, you know, just don't worry about it. Now get to work. Now you can turn your face to the world. For me, that's a very important concept. And then the massive New Testament witness and biblical witness, Old and New Testament, about the new heaven and the new earth, which is you know, it's very interesting. The language gets foggy enough so that Revelation can talk about a new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, but it's this world renewed. And that once one has had that vision, once you've seen the promised land, you can never be content. And you're always moving in the journey. Just another quote from him. This is on Revelation, which he finds to be a critical book in the New Testament. Very important book. He says, biblical mythology expresses this in its own way and asserts that salvation and disaster either have worldwide horizons or are pious illusions. Do you hear what he's saying in that situation? That all of this stuff is global, cosmic, and both in terms of salvation and in terms of disaster. One of the things the president of our church preached the installation service for our new bishop in November and ended with some kind of a remark about the fact that even if this world goes up in a nuclear holocaust and everything is burnt to a crisp, if one person was around to say Jesus is Lord, that's all that would matter. I think he would be weeping greatly. God would. And so I think the book of Revelation, you know, and this is what he's talking about when he says that salvation and disaster either have worldwide horizons or they're pious illusions. Either it's for the whole of creation or it doesn't matter. That's, I think, what he's saying. I want to close here soon. I don't want to close soon, but I have to. So, this one I want to get in because I think it's a perspective that we need. He says, it is grotesque that churches and Christians back away from these questions. These are political questions, either timidly or with the easiest of consciences, whereas for the last 25 years, they have been discussing all over Germany in deadly seriousness the question of the full or partial ministry of women. Now, what he's saying in the context of this is that the massive changes that have taken place in Europe and in Germany, and what has the church been debating hotly? And not that that's an unimportant question, because it has to do with the whole of a cosmic kind of thing about the role of women, but to make that the only issue, he can hardly understand it. He says, here indeed gnats are strained out, camels swallowed, and problems created in which Christian people show themselves as embarrassed as if they were still in a state of medieval parochialism. The church also has to take responsibility for what it has not done. The age of the atomic bomb is in fact an age of barbarism. Any disciple of Jesus who is concerned merely to keep his own name clean and is afraid to soil his hands reflects a caricature of the bourgeoisie, which in case of alarm pulls its nightcap over its eyes and forgets that its Lord died in no man's land on earth between zealots, although he himself was not a zealot. And then he has some more to say. He says, is there not a community of those who are oppressed and insulted which goes beyond all guilt and which Christians cannot evade? Are they innocent if, whether deliberately or not, even if only through their silence, their mistaken respect for authorities and their pious short-sightedness and narrow-mindedness, they have in the main given way to tyrants, supported the exploiters, and belonged to the privileged? Strong words, I think. I think I'd love to meet the guy. He probably would be a real pain in the neck. But then the last thing I want to say, because I think one of the things that this book, together with Klaus Westermann's book, does is it invites us to think in terms of new images. And So he says, who is there to think internationally if not those who preach God's reign on earth? It's a cosmic vision that he calls us to. And you see, we're free. Dan Erlander did a really good job last night of stressing the importance of the key Lutheran doctrine, justification by grace through faith. If we are justified, if that is taken care of, then whatever I do in the world, I do in freedom, because I don't do it to earn anything. I can give my life away. Why? Because it's secure. We have used justification by grace through faith to lead us to quietism, to do nothing, instead of seeing it as that which absolutely invigorates life. And I think that's what Kaiserman invites us to in Jesus Means Freedom. And he invites us to, you know, have a reckless pass at the Bible and be critical of it, but always understanding that both the Scriptures and ourselves stand under the Lordship of Jesus Christ. And that's the key to Jesus Means Freedom.